Hi everyone, thank you for joining us for CFG Podcast. I'm Zoe, I work in the customer and member support team, and I am joined by my colleague Dean from the partnerships team. This is the first episode of our podcast, isn't it? And we're really excited to be presenting it.
Yeah, it's an exciting time to be at CFG actually.
So can you just tell us a little bit more about what it's about?
So we're looking at doing a programme of innovation here. Lots of new things to be looking at, and the podcast was one that was top of the list. We're really excited about doing it. We thought it would be a great platform to engage with sector leaders from the charity and corporate world and look to ask them some tough questions and, you know, really get into their expertise. And then also it's a great way of providing content to a different audience and providing the same, you know, providing the content to the same audience in a different way. So good for a commute in the morning.
Yeah, and this week's episode focuses on risk management and viewing it in a different way. And later on in the episode, I get to chat to Karen Bradshaw and Dawn McNeish from our very own CFG. But first, Dean, you spoke to Jonathan Orchard from Sarah Vinson.
I did, yeah. Jonathan has been a great friend to CFG over the years. He's a partner at Sarah Vinson. So we were able to ask him some questions about risk to take when diversifying income in charities. So here's Jonathan. What do you think the overall approach to risk is in the charity sector?
Well, in my experience, charities still tend to look at risk from the perspective of what can go wrong. They're drawing up big worry lists. And this immediately gives risk management a negative connotation. So instead, what I would call intelligent risk management is more of an enabler. So it's about ensuring that there's an understanding of risk and a strong base of controls in place to give a charity the confidence to go out and actively take risks to further their charitable work and create more social impact. So the other negative impact that the worry list creates for me is the whole risk management bureaucracy, colour-coded spreadsheets and the endless need to keep them updated. And that's where all the effort goes to, rather than actively managing the risks themselves. So for me, the most valuable part of risk management is the discussion of risk that leads to risk-aware decisions being taken. And a risk register just isn't a very effective tool to enable that discussion to happen. So in the work that we do, we encourage charities to use positive language and seek out the opportunities that are there in risk. And income diversification is a good example of that, because you can come at it from the risk that over-reliance on too few sources of income can cause a significant drop in income, or you can say that there's an opportunity in diversifying our income base and guaranteeing our unrestricted income base for the next few years.
So I guess the next question we wanted to ask was, what should a finance professional ensure they are doing within the exec team when managing risk appetite at board level?
Well, I suppose a prerequisite for doing that is that the board is able to articulate its risk appetite in the first place. And it's easy for boards, I think, to lose their way in all the risk management speak and to overcomplicate things. But put simply, the risk appetite is about understanding where a charity will and won't be prepared to take risks and the boundaries to those risks. Income generation is an area where risk appetites tend to be higher, as the potential upside is very clear. So a board can set the financial boundaries in terms of levels of acceptable investment and future expected returns on that investment, and it can set the ethical boundaries about fundraising methods and any policies around who the charity maybe won't receive and accept funds from. So that would be how the board could set that risk appetite and give the management team the risk framework then to draw up income generation plans around. And so a good FD will be able to present a range of those scenarios, including a worst-case scenario, and clearly drawing out potential implications in terms of the investments needed, the impacts on reserves and cash flow. So it's about thinking about what the decision is and tailoring the information appropriately, thinking of the purpose, the audience, the desired end goal, building the information accordingly. And I think critically, remembering that financial analysis is as much about words as it is about numbers, and that a clear narrative to explain the assumptions, that underlie forecasts and the potential outcomes is much more important than any spreadsheet.
Okay, so Jonathan, at CFG obviously we work with charities of all, you know, shapes and sizes, board sizes, etc. We just wanted to ask sort of how do the factors of size, structure and income stream affect the risk level and approach to diversifying income that charities take?
Well, you're right that there are differences depending on the on the size of charities. But I think for all charities, they're all facing an environment at the moment where we've got demand for charitable services increasing, where we've got public grants reducing, where we've got contracts being squeezed. It's no surprise, therefore, that all charities, regardless of size or structure, are very much got income generation and income diversification on their to-do list. But I think, you know, it's just not an easy thing to do. And common strategies that we certainly see for smaller charities at the moment include things like targeting major donors and the high net worth individuals, developing corporate partnerships, and the digital channels, including things like crowdfunding. And on the one hand, unless you strike it lucky, these sorts of strategies are unlikely to produce game-changing outcomes. I think for smaller charities, it's very true that every little bit of additional unrestricted income is absolutely critical. From a strategic point of view, thinking about evolution rather than revolution in terms of income strategies is the way forward. And we've seen examples, for example, moving from charity shops, the extension of income from that source, moving to online sales and charity shops selling their goods on eBay, for example. And these sorts of relatively low ways of seeking new income streams, looking where your existing strengths lie and how those can be pushed a bit further, I think that's a strategy that every charity can be thinking about. And the risk of sort of going more down the revolution route and thinking more radically, well, we see examples of many charities who just underestimate the level of resource, skills and expertise that are needed to drive completely new income initiatives. So big charities that have hit the headlines where they've attempted to build new income streams and things have gone wrong. RNIB has been a recent example where they put a lot of charitable funds into commercial ventures that ultimately didn't prove successful. And then you've got reputational risks of going down that route as well, and I think we saw that a couple of years ago with Age UK and E.ON as well. So you've got all these different elements to be thinking about, but I think charities must feel free to seek out new opportunities and not shy away from taking well-managed risks in pushing the boundaries. And I think it was Deborah Alcock-Tyler from DSC who said that a charity is defined not by how it raises its money, but on how it spends its money. And I think that's exactly right. You know, commercial income streams must be considered as part of that charity income mix.
Okay, cheers, Jonathan. Thanks. Some great examples in there. Also great to hear a shout-out for corporate partnerships as CFG's partnership officer. I guess we wanted to finish on some key takeaways, maybe five key things to be thinking about in terms of income generation at charities moving forward.
Okay, sure. I think number one, I would say, is about making sure that you're seeking to diversify for the right reasons. I think, you know, the right reasons being to reduce financial risk, to enhance your impact. I think the wrong reason for seeking income diversification is to prop up loss-making operations. So make sure you're seeking to diversify for the right reasons. Secondly, when trying out new opportunities and new ways of diversifying income, thinking about what sort of agile risk management processes are needed. It's things like, you know, running pilots, avoiding putting too much fixed cost into your cost base, keeping regular reporting on progress so that if it's not working, you can stop quickly. It's the old adage of if you're going to fail, fail quickly, and then move on to something else. I think a third point would be one income diversification strategy that is often overlooked is seeking out a merger. is actually one of the easier ways, if mergers are ever easy, of diversifying your income streams by looking for other organisations that have got complementary income streams. If you've got one charity that's strong in public fundraising and one that's strong in institutional funding, then they would lend themselves to be a good match. A fourth one is to look inside the charity first and look at whether you are sitting on intangible assets that could generate an income stream. An example of that would be a client of mine, a children's charity that had very strong child protection policies and procedures, and in the current environment with the focus on safeguarding, they've identified the fact they can go out and train other organisations on safeguarding and child protection and generate an income stream from that. And the fifth really is that success will also depend on organisational culture. Because if you're going to have to be out there innovating, trying new things, that needs to be done, or you'll be much more successful at doing it in an open and transparent culture where failure is viewed as okay, and where lessons are learned for next time. To maximise the success, you know, use the positive language, bring the staff on board and give everybody a role and see the opportunities that are there rather than the downsides.
Well, some really good points from Jonathan.
Yeah, he was really cool to speak to. Thanks so much to him for doing that. Hopefully those points can help charities out moving forward. So you got to interview our director and CEO. How was that?
Yeah, so a little bit more formal than I'm used to, but they had some great things to say about developing a new approach to risk management and also embedding that within the culture of the organisation. So, yeah, take it away. Welcome, Dawn and Karen, to the first episode of the CFG podcast and for sharing your experiences in your approach to risk and changing things up in CFG. I was just hoping you could give us a brief introduction into how things are changing at CFG at the moment.
Of course. So if we start with the CFG leadership strategy, one of our strands of activity is that we want to be seen as an exemplar within the sector. And so that's made us really focus in on how do we manage risk and what part do people play and culture play within the risk management process.
And Dawn, what are your thoughts?
So from my perspective and for my team, it's about really looking at the products and services that we deliver, focusing much more on the impact, what we're trying to achieve, but also just trying to be a little bit more flexible and more innovative, being able to pull back on things that we've done in the past, thinking a lot more about what it is we're trying to achieve rather than just running the same activities over and over again, and coming at it from a risk management process of thinking, how are we going to be more sustainable in the future? Not just for ourselves, but in better supporting our members.
One of the things we've really been trying to achieve is a truly embedded risk approach, so that it isn't something that is separated by committees and different structures. It's actually part of everything that we do in every activity that we undertake.
I know in my time at CFG, I felt part of that approach to managing risk, and it's been a very much a proactive and dynamic approach. But how was sort of the approach before you started on this journey, and how did you identify what you needed to change?
So I think we were probably very traditional in the way that we approached risk, and we followed all of the best practice and the industry sort of standards. But what our experience showed us was that sometimes the outcomes of having those really good processes doesn't necessarily lead to avoidance of risk or great outcomes, and indeed sometimes really good outcomes happen by luck or by chance. So what we were trying to do was be a bit more proactive, if you like, in how we approach risk, so that what we were receiving as a consequence was more of an intended outcome to what we were doing, rather than it being something that we were trying to predict or happening by chance. So that sort of a traditional approach has its limitations, and we think that this much more flexible approach enables us to achieve much more quickly.
And of course the other benefit of having a more embedded approach across the organisation is that it doesn't just sit with a few. So I think it's fair to say that we were quite top heavy. Decisions were made by a few at the top, whereas now it's across the entire organisation, across everything that we do. So I've been really lucky in my time at CFG to have moved around the organisation, to have been promoted and given those opportunities in future. others can follow that, and we can have the confidence and know that they're going to be able to manage those things because they've already been exposed to it.
So in terms of where we are heading to, what has the shift in attitude and focus been?
So I think probably the best way I can answer that is to give an example. Often you'll find within sort of traditional risk registers things like loss of key member of staff as a line in your risk register. And what that tends to do is drive you down the path of thinking about what would you do if you lost a key member of staff. So interims, continuity plans, temporary staff, things like that. But if you turn it on its head and say, well, actually, how do we create a positive environment where people feel empowered, where decisions are distributed across the organisation, where an individual is not indispensable, and I don't mean that you don't value individuals' contributions, but rather you don't make one person a weak link in a chain if they were to suddenly disappear, then you start driving down a very different path, which is much more about a positive culture, which is about trying to empower people, which is about looking at your practices in a much more positive way. And then the outcomes of that aren't just about safeguarding against the loss of a key member of staff, it actually has much greater and wider reaching benefits. So that's the biggest shift that we've had. We've stopped asking how do we prevent bad stuff happening, although clearly we want to avoid bad stuff happening, and started to say, is there a different way and a more positive way that we can start trying to drive a better culture and do what we do in a better way, a more impactful way?
It sounds like you made some really positive decisions regarding risk management, but practically, how did those conversations go at SMT and board level?
So I think probably the honest answer is they were quite challenging for all of us, because although you can all agree that your primary duty to your stakeholders is not to avoid all risks at all costs, it's to maximise impact, those warm words are so what? So what does that mean in real terms? And when I proposed, for example, that we threw our risk register out, I think both the SMT and the board were quite alarmed about what that might mean. It's not quite as controversial or as radical as it might sound, because what we've replaced it with is two things. One is looking at the controls, processes, steps that we need to take to try and avoid problems and to manage the environment in which we work. And the second is then monitoring the things that do arise or things that we are predicting could be arising in the not too distant future. And that risk issues log means that we are on a regular basis forcing ourselves to have conversations about how effective our risk management has been, but also are we taking the opportunities that are coming up from the various things that we're encountering. And I think often organisations can fall foul of not seizing opportunities because they're so hung up on managing the risk bit.
I think one of the things that I found really helpful was the business model workshop, which is actually a really good example of the change in approach as well. Originally that was going to be held at SMT level. We then decided to do it with the entire staff team. And that was a really good way of just going through everything that we did, testing some of those assumptions that we made, and really challenging why we do what we do and if there are different ways of doing it. The other thing that helped us on this journey was developing an innovation group, which is why we're here today, and having that pipeline of new stuff that we can be developing as we go along. So just continually refreshing, challenging why we're doing what we're doing and what's going to get us to where we want to be as quickly as possible.
What have you learned from this process?
So I think for me the biggest lesson has been that there's a cliche that says culture eats strategy for breakfast, but we've recognised, I think, that culture eats everything for breakfast, and that you can have the best processes in the world around risk, but if you don't get the culture and the attitude right, then the whole thing falls down. So that probably is my biggest one, the understanding that what motivates people and why they make decisions is much more influential to the good risk management than anything else.
Yeah, I would second that. One of the things that struck me the most throughout this process was what I was saying versus how people were feeling, and the fact that we were talking about having a different approach, but people's actual experience living it didn't correlate with that. So really letting go rather than just talking about letting go, giving people permission to fail, but really meaning it, So if you're saying it's okay to go and innovate into risk, but then you're constantly focusing on what we see as failures and what people perceive as failures, then the living experience doesn't match up to the words that you're saying. And that's probably the thing that struck me the most about this entire process, and we're still working on it now.
You mentioned it's an ongoing process. So looking forward, what are you feeling positive about?
For me, last year, I'm going to go back to the annual conference from last year. Lynn Berry opened at our annual conference by inviting us to think about, instead of asking people what empowers them, what is it that we were doing to disempower them. And I feel like the risk management piece has really moved us forward. It's kind of an aha moment for me that what, a lot of what we were doing process-wise was disempowering people. And I'm really positive about the fact that people are embracing and taking responsibility for risk across the organisation. They seem to feel really empowered.
So what key takeaway would you give to a charity looking to go on this journey?
Key takeaway for me would be that although it might feel counterintuitive at first, it is okay to let go a bit and give away some control. The process is just that, and it's what guides you to what you need to be doing. But the most important thing is the people. And in order to get them on board, you have to give away and let them have some authority and really believe in the process and trust that you have everything that you need.
So I think my takeaway would be we can't eradicate risk. It's inherent in everything that we do. And whatever mechanisms or registers you have or you might have in place, actually the most powerful management tool for risk is having the freedom and the willingness to have the right conversations at the right levels and at the right times.
Yeah, I hope anyone listening, no matter what kind of charity you're from or where you're based regionally, you could take away something from Dawn and Karen there.
So we've come to the end of our first podcast, Zoe.
Yes, we have. But don't worry, you can access more of this information at our upcoming events. And you can find a full programme of our events on our website at cfg.org.uk. And don't forget that CFG members have access to free members' meetings throughout the year as well.
Thanks for listening.